Our presentation today is entitled Religion and Reality, a Long-Running Competition. These are some of the writings of Jim Struthers, a former member of this fellowship, and our presenters are his son and daughter-in-law, Ethel and Jamie Struthers. And I think they don't really need much of an introduction. They've been part of this fellowship for a long, long time. I think everyone knows them. So, Jamie and Ethel, without further ado.
Good morning. Ethel and I are here to read a couple of short essays from a book of my father's essays, Religion and Reality, a Long-Standing Competition. And some might suggest a shameless promotion of the same. Before Ethel and I continue, I'd like to, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't recognize the efforts of several members of the Regina Unitarians that have been instrumental in this project, and particularly Sandra Allen, who has spent many hours of editing of the original materials, and without whom I'm sure we would not be nearly as far ahead as we are now. So the plan, very briefly, is that Ethel and I will each read a short essay from the collection, followed by one last short piece, which is backed by popular demand. So, again, if I'll kick things off, an essay, What Religion Is About, and which goes as follows. This somewhat presumptuous title is intended to indicate a consideration of suggestions regarding such more specific questions as, has our fellowship been performing a religious function? What indeed is the essential nature of religion? And what appeal does religion have, or should it have, for me? We are all aware that religion exhibits a highly ambiguous nature. Religion was among the earliest cultural manifestations of humanity, and to this day, traditional religions incorporate some of its primitive origins. Many primitive religions centered on horrifying practices of human and animal sacrifices. Modern Christianity still focuses on the vicarious sacrifices of the cross and symbolically reenacts the savagery of eating the flesh and drinking the blood of the sacrificial victim. There is no instance that I'm aware of where religion has contributed to the body of knowledge upon which civilization is founded. Religion has been based on the imaginative and invincible ignorance of many of the mundane facts of the real world. Not only that, but religion has consistently fought as threatening the spirit of inquiry, whether personified in Socrates, Galileo, or Darwin. One case against religion was eloquently stated by the American criminal lawyer of the Scopes trial fame, Clarence Darrow, when he said, "The truth," he said, "is that the origin of what we call civilization is not due to religion, but due to skepticism." He went on to say, "When every event was a miracle, when there was no order, when systems or no order or systems or law, there was no occasion for studying any subject or being interested in anything except a religion which took care of the soul," he said. The modern world is the child of doubt and inquiry, as the ancient world was the child of fear and faith. While religion undoubtedly has been a stultifying influence on the advancement of knowledge and the application of intelligence, that is not, of course, the whole story. Religion has been marvelously creative, a creative influence in art, literature, and architecture. It has achieved new moral insights to replace the blind alleys of savagery. Above all, it has served humanity's instinct to find a protective home amidst the ever-present terrors of a dimly understood world. In the history of the human spirit, wrote theologian Martin Buber, I distinguish between epochs of habitation and epochs of homelessness. In the former, a man lives as in a house, as in a home. In the latter, a man lives in the world as in an open field, and at times does not even have four pegs with which to set up a tent. Needless to say, in Buber's terms, our era is one of homelessness. The last great period of Christian habitation was during the medieval Christian synthesis. It provided a spiritual home whose warmth and power was symbolized in the soaring grandeur of the great cathedrals, which we still view with reverent awe today. But even as the stones were being laid, there was a rising in Florence, Venice, Pisa, Milan, the intellectual ferment that was effectively to destroy the cozy world of medieval Christianity. Significantly, our own denomination was born amidst the Italian Renaissance. The next major domination of the Christian structure resulted from 18th century rationalism, which when again Unitarianism blossomed in the English-speaking world. The 19th century saw the final erosion of foundations with the triumph of Darwinism and the supplementation of Newtonian physics by relativity and quantum theories. There could no longer be an easy faith for those seeking consolation of religion. But religion, I believe, does not depend upon the fate of Christian mythology or the mythology of any other religion for that matter. The impulse to religion is the impulse to achieve satisfying relationships to the great world around us, relations to our fellow humans, and relations within our own psyche. And as our understanding of these factors change, so must the nature of our relationships. A vast universe of almost inconceivable immensity, operating in accordance with the predictable regularity of natural forces, cannot engender the same relation as a bit of the Eastern Mediterranean under a bowl and ruled by an invisible but divine despot. Our relation to the world today must be increasingly governed by our understanding that it is comprised of a delicate ecology which requires loving care if it is to continue to serve us well as a physical home. While it may be thoroughly practical, our concern for our planet should be an essentially religious one. Similarly, when we relate to our fellow humans, we are no longer concerned with the mythological nonsense of Adam and Eve, sin and salvation. We know that we're the product of 3 million years of traceable evolution and at least 40,000 years of cultural development. Our animal and primitive instinctual heritage is still very much with us. And we have some understanding of our individual layered psyches operating in many ways beyond our control and even beyond our knowledge. A living religion cannot be based on dead mythology if it is to have a creative relevance to our lives. It must deal with reality as we know it, not the reality of a long-dead culture. But this does not mean that the essential nature of religion is that different. In searching for satisfying relations with the world, with others, and within oneself, the tools are still reverence, awe, and love. We are in search not of the facts like the scientist, but of life-enhancing personal relationships that satisfy both our emotions and our intellect. Finally, it is probably wise to consider a contention of the late theologian Paul Tillich, who emphasized that what was missing in modern religion, as in life generally, was the dimension of depth. There is a strong tendency, he said, to move horizontally on the surface of things. There is a failure to confront the ultimate questions of religion. Who am I? What is life's meaning? There is instead a tendency to provide pat and facile answers to the questions of achieving shallow and fleeting satisfactions. Tillich felt true religion could only be achieved, if at all, through a struggle with the ultimate questions of life. He defined the divine as that which was held to be of ultimate concern. As the great Unitarian Theodore Parker used these words, "Be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere, its temple, all space, its shrine, the good heart, its creed, all truth, its ritual, works of love." Ethel's going to pick up from there with another essay.
As I was listening to Jamie read the presentation that Jim had made on what religion is all about, I realized that the one that I'm about to read again, you're going to see similarities, and I can see that. It reminded me of something that Sandra had asked at one point. And she had asked whether or not we had dates for these presentations, because it's kind of interesting to see how Jim's ideas have evolved, or, again, how he continues to wrestle with this theme, religion and reality, a long-running competition. And you will definitely see that as you read through this. I wanted to maybe add a few words. I firstly wanted to thank Donna, who definitely was someone who said, we need a book. You've got to ensure that we get a book. And then along with that, then it was very much Sandra who kept the book happening. And then it was Jane who actually had a chance to read the book, Jane and Al, with Jim on that first day. All of us, it was really tremendous that this whole thing happened. And it's now, as we get a chance to begin to read through these presentations and take time with them, it's really interesting to think a lot about what Jim has offered us. So mine is called The Uses and Abuses of Imagination. So I'd like to read this one because, again, Jim comes at it again, emphasizing just another angle. I'm sure everyone believes they have a robust imagination. I think if anyone was charged with being unimaginative, they would be indignant, as if they were said to have no sense of humor. But what is imagination? An encyclopedia definition includes the following. Imagination is the ability to form mental images. It helps provide meaning to experience and understanding to knowledge. It is a fundamental faculty through which people make sense of the world. And it also plays a key role in the learning process. It is the ability to invent personal realms within the mind from elements derived from sense perceptions of the shared world. A dictionary definition calls imagination the creative part of the mind, the part where ideas, thoughts, and images were formed, are formed. Imagination is a nexus of both emotion and rational thought. And in a small, everyday way, it influences most of our activities. When we arise in the morning, what clothes shall we wear? What shall we do today? Do a washing, go shopping, visit a friend, go to the library? Many of these questions are canvassed by our imagination, and some of our decisions will likely be determined by the answers our imagination gives us. But it is not these mundane and routine functions of imagination that I want to discuss, but rather the larger matters where imagination is in play. Albert Einstein is famously quoted to the effect that imagination is much more powerful than knowledge, since knowledge is static, while imagination leads into new and unknown. The history of science is correctly summed up in the statement of the philosopher John Dewey when he said, "Every great advance in science has issued from a new audacity of imagination." However, imagination is only one element in science and other forms of knowledge. Imagination alone is notoriously unreliable. It produces all sorts of ideas and answers which are wrong or useless, or both wrong and useless. One extra element needed to produce science or otherwise useful thought is empiricism. That is, the application by the rational part of the mind of information concerning the real world derived through the senses. One of the world's greatest scientists, Sir Isaac Newton, once said to the proponents of new scientific ideas, "Do not give me your reasons. Show me the results of your experiments." The second extra element is skepticism. So that every scientific theory is subject to critical examination by others, which results in either acceptance or rejection in the long run. Of course, the primacy of imagination goes far beyond the field of science. William Shakespeare said it poetically in the line, "The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are all compact of imagination." And this is true, not just of poetry, but of the arts that undergird our culture. Most literature is based on imagination, and so is music, painting, sculpture, and architecture. History is largely an imaginative reconstruction of the past based on limited factual knowledge. Philosophy and other scholarship, even mathematics, partake of imaginative speculations. The products of imagination are the foundation of civilization, but also people must exercise their own imaginative faculties to even partake of these riches. Reading a novel or watching a play, a movie, or a TV episode usually arouses our imagination. It triggers what Samuel Taylor Coleridge termed a willing suspension of disbelief during that experience. Our imagination is aroused to take us out of our everyday consciousness and immerse us in the imaginative story or item we are experiencing. In fact, I think it can be said that we largely live in a world of imagination, a world of our own imagination, which sometimes fails to keep contact with reality. And it is here that abuse of imagination often takes place. And one abuse is fraudulent advertising. Stephen Leacock once defined advertising as the science of arresting the human intelligence long enough to get money from it. And in other words, advertising attempts its extractive effort through an appeal to our imagination rather than our rationality. The annual all-new car, that is, the one with the modified chrome trim, is aimed at arousing the customer's imagination. Lotteries are another abuse. They extract money from modest income people with dreams of riches, while in fact the chances of winning are vanishingly small. And furthermore, they legitimize the concept of the concentration of wealth in a few hands, which is one of the roots of the world's problems. Another and devastating abuse of imagination is the use of fear as a mechanism of social influence and control. Human beings tend to suffer from an underlying anxiety, which is left over from ancestral hazards in the rough and tumble of evolutionary natural selection. Those ancestors with greater fears tended better to survive the very real dangers of a savage environment. Hermann Göring enunciated the use of fear for social control in Nazi Germany. Promoting fear of an external enemy was the easiest way to create support and obedience of the population to their erstwhile defenders, he said. The same abuse of imagination has been adopted by the United States Bush administration under their Homeland Security Administration following the 9/11 terrorist attack. It is even organized into three levels, yellow, orange, and red, so that the level of fear can be manipulated in support of the disastrous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and for other political purposes. The two major areas of life where both the use and abuse of imagination play vital roles are social organization and religion. In the realm of social organization, imagination is involved in the equation between leaders and followers. The leaders have an imaginative picture of what the society should be like, and they strive to make the mass of followers buy into it. Dictatorial regimes can have a long history, as in ancient Egypt, and a shorter run in the Roman Empire, or a brief span as the Nazi regime. Most would agree that the monopoly of power by a small leader clique is an abuse of the imagination. Democratic regimes have the benefit of widespread and diverse imaginary goals, as well as the corrective influence of skepticism and imperialism on the part of the followers. Predating complex social organization were imaginative beliefs of a religious nature. A pervasive belief was animism, and it is the belief that the human bodies contain souls. And furthermore, that all other animals and plants, as well as inanimate objects such as rivers and mountains, also contain souls. Animism still exists amongst a few primitive societies today. And there was also belief in free souls released from the bodies of dead humans and other animals. As human society became more settled through agriculture and urbanization, human imagination modified earlier beliefs to create a supernatural world for two purposes. One purpose was to explain the origin, meaning, and vicissitudes of the real world, and to validate social and individual ethics. The second purpose was to provoke a consoling denial of the reality of death. The result has been a great variety of supernatural worlds and mythical inhabitants, which varied with the nature and needs of the different cultures which created them in imagination. Perhaps the ugliest aspect of these superstitions has been the need to appease or bribe the ruling god or gods. With animal or human sacrifice, the human victims were often children or babies. And in some cases, such as the Mayans, thousands of war prisoners were slaughtered en masse. Belief in the reality of these imaginary supernatural construct has always been widespread, although, as Plato said of ancient Greece, a certain portion of mankind do not believe at all in the existence of gods. The Western world has been dominated for almost 2,000 years by the Judeo-Christian religious imagination, and the Middle East for 1,400 years by the Islamic imitation. These monotheistic religions have contributed much to the human culture in terms of music, painting, and architecture, and limited areas of compassion. Islam contributed to genuine learning by transmitting classical Greek and Roman knowledge and literature to Western Europe, where Christianity had been desperately destroying secular knowledge, which was considered a threat to its imaginative supernaturalism. But the religious record in many other respects is horrendous. Over the centuries, religions have been primarily responsible for, or excuses for, almost continuous warfare, individual and mass murder, torture, oppression, and a cult of ignorance and superstition. And this has continued right to the present time among adherents who do not qualify their beliefs with common sense and a human outlook. Christians of today should recognize that the core of their theology and its symbol, the cross, is an echo of the ancient obscenity of human sacrifice as atonement for a mythical original sin. And Islamic extremists, of course, are currently practicing both murder and human sacrifice with hijacked airliners and explosive underwear. These, it seems to me, are abuses of the imagination. And so that was the essay of Jim's on the uses and abuses of imagination.
My father also had a practical side. And when he wasn't participating in the discussions, he attended to a number of mundane but just as essential tasks to the fellowship, as making sure the heat was on at the center and that there was an ample supply of strong coffee. I digress, but I have often wondered whether the modern Unitarian movement could possibly survive without coffee and the coffee hour. In this spirit, Requiem for the Beast in the Basement. We have in our basement an authentic symbol of the genesis of our power-driven age, which I'll personify as the Beast. The Industrial Revolution was based upon coal and steam, and so was the heating of our building for many of its 78 years. I think it's actually now 85 years. Next to the furnace room is a former coal bin, which I'm sure could hold at least 5 tons. Mercifully, when we acquired the center in 1992, the era of coal had passed. Except for the generation of electricity on a grand scale. So when Jim arrived at 7 a.m. on a frigid Sunday morning, he did not have to shovel a hundredweight of coal into the maw of the beast. He just adjusted the thermostat, and natural gas did the rest. Regardless of the type of fuel, the beast has labored faithfully over the years, in the words of T.S. Eliot, to keep our metaphysics warm. It has had its troubles, of course. These were ministered to expertly and kindly by a technician named Neville. But Neville retired last spring. Within the weeks, the beast suffered a fatal leak, thereby turning itself into simply a symbol of times gone by. Farewell, old friend. May you rest in peace. Amen. Thank you.